I'll begin with you, Catherine, while we wait for Anselm. Of course, I mean, thoroughly enjoyed listening to you, as usual. This necessary decline of French art so that American art could rise is not only the work of art historians, but it's also the work of major institutions. Do you want to talk a bit about the role of the MoMA? And I mean, at least because it was also part of these interrogating the canon exhibition. It was part of the parapolitics, actually.
Yeah, I mean, we could talk about MoMA, and I think a lot did it. But for me, what I was even more interested is how simply the system in France and Europe, because yes, France is losing its position, but it's also because economically France is no longer in position. I mean, it's also linked to me. Yes, there is MoMA is trying, but MoMA is promoting abstract expressionism.
Yes.
Okay, but the triumph, and that's something I've been saying a long time, but the triumph of American art in Europe is not the triumph of abstract expressionism. Abstract expressionism arrived late in Europe. By the time it arrived, it's not that relevant. The triumph of American art in Europe is a triumph of pop art. Nowhere best in that in Germany, you know this. I mean, if American art triumph, it's because the German and the Belgian embrace and the Italian embraced pop art in the early 1960s. And until then, collectors do not buy American artists. There is D'Autremont is, I mean, like you have a few collectors who shift in England, in Belgium, but they are not buying those work until much later. So yes, there is this political Cold War, that is true, but there is also the reality. I think this is also the way we see it, but at the time, the European were, they did not know Pollock. Pollock arrived really late. I mean, it's 58, the big retrospective that come. He's already dead. I mean, you have a few exhibitions, but how many people see it? Not that many. What are the work on display? The She-Wolf. None of you know that work. But it's not a typical abstract expressionism. Rothko, I mean, is hardly seen in Europe. So I think what people, so that's the point of the book, is also to show that it's more like the cultural shift, yes, happened in the 60s with America, but it's also an economic crisis that touched the French art market, which killed everybody, and that the collector also are now able to take the plane and the jet, allow you to go to the US, and before you don't go, the German collector, dealer, start to go to the US in 63. I mean, yeah, I'm not repeating myself, but I've done it. So I think MoMA did a lot, but it's almost like retrospectively, but really, that's when you, what I say by geopolitics is also to look at currency.
Yep.
And I mean, I spend a lot of time, Germany is for me like a big part of my book, even though it's called American art, because for a certain reason. But if you see also like why the Germans start to buy American art, without the German, there would be no triumph of American art. I mean, it's true, it's like the big collector. Look at all the work you have in all those museums in Köln. I mean, Ludwig is one example, Karl Strohr. But that's why I had the photo of Strohr with boys, because at the same time they buy German artists, they exhibit German artists. And in the 70s, when conceptual art is important, we all know American conceptual art. Yes, but no American is buying conceptual art. The only that are buying are Italian, Dutch, German, Belgium. Without them, the American gallery can close. But the German gallery also exhibit this, and it becomes a shift. When the American economy collapsed in the 70s, then you have Germany, we're so rich, and the Deutschmark. I mean, I'm not a big economist, but if you just look at the buying power of German compared to the American buying power, you understand why in the 80s they are the best collector. And they can buy and they can say, and why do the American galleries to welcome German art in the 80s? Well, because that's what their collector want, and then it's, but they prefer to buy German art from New York. I mean, then it, and then it's like all this, that's the collect, it's not, it's yes. So, I mean, MoMA, I think a lot of people have done it before me, and I think it's important, but I think there is other things that have to do with money, with finance, with where you put, where you invest, and currency. Anyway, I talk too much. Sorry.
We'll take your questions. I just want to ask, and someone could, how do you, in the map of being the head of the visual arts department of this grand old house, what are the safeguards that you put for your blind spots? I mean, you've covered, like, this Canon Fragen is a super ambitious project. It's borderline insane in its scope, in what it wanted to do, in what it accomplished. And I keep wondering, you know, what is this curatorial, what does curatorial practice produce? I mean, how do we qualify the knowledge produced by curators? Because the, I mean, of course there's the catalogs, but then there's the experience of exhibition visiting or being in an exhibition, which is a completely different thing, which you addressed. But how do you, what are the safeguards for your blind spots? I mean, what, how, when do you think, is it a conversation with this list of curators that you thanked, which practically cover the world, or is it reading anthropology, or?
I don't know, I mean, the safeguard is, of course, a really difficult question. I mean, in practice, it's, you know, most of the knowledge you produce, you are not producing, you are collecting it, you draw it together, you maybe, you form it into a narrative, because you can't not do so, and you also have to. And in doing so, you make difficult decisions. But it's profound. I mean, for me, it's, every exhibition is in a way based on, you know, a handful of key books and a handful of key artists, and then the authors of the books, to be with some of them in intense exchange, and a handful of artists who are ideally able to unsettle in their aesthetic practice, you know, some of the certainty of this, that the discourse produces in this other handful of books. No, so I mean, you know, like in an exhibition level, that, because that's so necessary, no, like that you somehow create a productive tension between discourse and the work has to resist what is said about it, because otherwise it, there is, you know, it, not always, not absolutely always, but ideally there's a strong moment in every exhibition where the entire construction becomes also shaken by something that opens up in an aesthetic experience. You know, to produce this indeterminacy and then to reground it and to have a different relationship to it. No? And ideally it's an oscillation between these. Yeah.
Questions? Paula, you had a question.
Thank you so much for your papers. I had a comment and question for Catherine, because of course this you explain beautifully, you know, the construction of this canonical view on how it's difficult and we cannot go, we cannot add new chapters. But you know, coming from another, you know, from another place, which is not France, which is not the US, coming from Spain, I feel always very uncomfortable with that we continue to discuss whether Paris fall or not, and what if there was the triumph of the United States, which of course there is a narrative that exists and we cannot deny. But you know, what about the experience of the artists? You know, because coming from Spain, Latin America, and other places of the world, the fall of Paris was not evident at all. Actually, the fact that the buying power of collectors was not something that interested them. The symbolic power of Paris was so strong. And so I think that should we continue to discuss in this dimension between Paris and New York? Because, for example, Pollock arrived in 1959 in Paris, but in Spain was visible in 1955 because of the economic dealings that the Franco regime was doing with the United States. And so the artists, the Spanish artists, this really backwards continent in the south of Europe that didn't interest anybody, we were very well informed about the abstract expressionism, and they were interested to abstract expressionism, but they were fascinated for Paris. Paris was the reference, and it was there in Paris in which Arroyo met the people from the Young Pontieu. So, I mean, I was wondering about this necessity to think other players into and put other players into question, not just geographically, and also thinking Paris from a decentralized perspective, because it was absolutely full of foreign artists that were meeting there, and through there looking to other symbolic capitals, as it will be Havana, as I will explain later, but that had also an important role to play. So I was wondering, this history of the triumph of the United States, which is of course visible in the historiography, so how can we place that in a, for me, it's more the after war, after the Second World War, is more about a pluricentric network of capitals in which artists were working and relating to each other, you know? I don't know if it's a question, actually.
I agree completely with you. What you say is perfectly right. I mean, maybe because, you know, as coming from the US, I mean, studying in the US, you arrive as a PhD student from France, and it's like, oh, Greenberg, and Paris. So it's maybe also my background coming and speaking from an American point of view, where it's Paris and New York, that I'm responding to this. But you are right. I mean, like, everything you say, that was my perspective. So it's like, well, my only possibility is to deconstruct this, because I cannot simply ignore it. So I try to deconstruct it. And then with the other book, where I invited people to write essays that talk about all this, to show in English, so that it would show that it was more complicated. But I agree with you, it's a story, it's the way it was written in textbook, in the, you know, but I think I'm coming, you know, when you leave and study in the US, then it's the story you get. So I think I'm responding from that perspective, and that's maybe the audience, I mean, that was my, you know, so, but you are completely right with everything you say, but it's not something that people know.
No, because if not, a Spanish artist wouldn't fit, no, neither in the United States, neither in Paris, and it's like, even no, if we then deconstruct that, we don't find a way of talking about these kind of questions.
Yeah, yes. And for me, it's like, if you start to show how problematic it is, then it all crumbled, and then there is space to think outside and see like how it's different in each place. And for Spanish artists, for Latin American artists, they would not go to the US. I mean, many Latin American artists could not or would not want, so they went to Paris, and there was a lot of things. But, you know, if you open any big survey of post-war art, none of the artists, those artists, are going to be mentioned. or they are, you know, absent.
But I mean, if I may just add, I think also in terms of what you wrote in the book, I think of it very much as a kind of, you know, like decentering from within, no, like yeah. it because the whole, you know, Paris may be a physical locale, but it's a node, it's a node of since the 1920s, the latest, if not earlier, it's a. It cannot even be conceived without Indochina, without you know, that half, that slightly smaller of the two world empires, and I think that the entire construction and how also I see your article fitting in here is that, you know, it really is about this doing this decentering from within, and then it starts actually to communicate with everything else that Christine and Rasha have put together here in completely. I mean, there is of course in a term like decentering always this dialectical trap that you may, you know, in critiquing you may be stay invested with the object of critique in libidinal forms, and it's this is a big problem of a slightly different register though.
But I also hope that in the book what I was trying to say that the center, it's actually there is nothing in Paris. It's not Paris, it's not New York, it's the rest of the world who make it the center by the attention. So actually the big player, the important people are not in Paris. It's, I mean, if I explain myself well, it's like, well, if you are in Berlin, if you are in Brussels, where do you look at? And that's the power is in the periphery, so-called periphery, because they are the one who decide who they think is important. And it's when that shift change of the big collector of the market, then, you know, there was never any collector in Paris. You know, museums are not interested. That's why it could collapse completely. So I think it's like deconstructing from within, but also showing that this word center is a very bad word, because it makes us believe that there is like a reality. Well, it's attention, it's representation. It's how do you see the story? How do you imagine things? Where do artists want to exhibit? Do they want to exhibit in New York, in Paris, in Berlin? It's about attention, it's about desire, but it's not a physical thing. So, I don't know, it's more fluid. So that's what I was trying to show, but yeah.
When I was listening to the two of you, and I was wondering whether we should use pluriversal, like we should bring in that word so as to avoid this construction of periphery and center. Because there were many places vibrating or becoming like fulcrums of attention at the same time. And where do you want to exhibit? Well, I mean, I think suddenly it became the New Delhi Biennale or the Cairo Biennale or the Sao Paulo Biennale, and it was really meaningful to come back to Paris and say, I just came back from XYZ. Any other questions?
Thank you. I just wanted to ask Anselm if in this discussion of the identitarian problem and the whether we end up in the euphoric part of tripping in the exhibition or the paranoiac one, if in the kind of balance sheet in your curatorial approach to those possibilities, how have you seen over the course of this project, has your thinking changed about the risk of the paranoiac side, given the increasing identitarian trend in this country?
I don't know how to answer this. It's a very good question, and I do think it does have changed, or it's like the sensors are definitely, you know, tuning into other dimensions of it. But I'm not simply not able to, I haven't fully processed this. It's also because there's always the, only this amplitude of, like you dive into this hardcore production and then for short moments you come out to reflect on the, but then you really make these decisions so much in encounters, in actual discussions, in this tunnel of working with people, and covering, like, you know, speaking to layer and layer of history, that when you come back sort of to look at it from the outside, it of course always you recognize what has changed, but I haven't really I wouldn't be able to put words to that in with regards to this question. Maybe later today.
I mean, I remember when we did the research around the involvement of GDR artists, the union, the curator, etc., to include in Past is Quiet, and how difficult it was to find. We're both non-German, we're both outsiders. We're not from this wounded history that has yet to scar, and how complicated it was to find the right language, because a lot of the people we interviewed had not been spoken to since 1989, and they were holding positions with some kind of power in the Ministry of Culture or in the unions or in the Foreign Service. And it was really complicated to find, so as not to offend people that we who were going to come to the exhibition, and to acknowledge what these other people had done, and to really step out of a blanket statement or a flat history where people were commanded to do things or were expected to do things, to try to bring back a little subjectivity and individuality. And I think we upset one reporter. It's fine.
I mean, I could more anecdotally add to the, of course, like in a project like Parapolitics, but also in others, you know, you face this very particular problem also of if you in general you try to make exhibitions that are not wholeheartedly affirming everything they show, but you weave a net of really complicated, sometimes outrightly painful material, and you are trying to build a frame around it that forces you know, a certain distance to the material, so it's not basically about celebration. Yeah? It's not like the classic art exhibition, of course, is just saying here art has been accomplished, and this in a research exhibition, and like it's very different what is said. No? But you have a very complicated relationship then to some of the collaborators, to some of the artists. So, for instance, a very outrageous form of the Parapolitics exhibition could have been, you know, to basically show CIA-funded art. In fact, there were very, very little CIA funding ever reached in artist studios. I mean, a lot of writers, a lot of big cultural events, some smaller, very few ever ended up in the hands of any painter or so. But of course, this would have resulted in a kind of denunciatory debunking that is completely, that is outrageous, that could not have been done. No? So it was very clear from the beginning. I mean, you would otherwise end up, you know, even not perhaps with the same ideology, with the same murderous ideology, you would basically end up doing a degenerate art exhibition, you know, a debunking. So we had to find a different way of dealing with this. And yet, you know, still a lot of the people we had to speak to, who, like our way of dealing with this was basically not showing artists from this generation, but more the generation that had reacted to it, that had already to deal with the problem of either kind of a, you know, a radical anti-autonomy a la Situationist International, or this autonomy of the Free West, which was basically a prison for, no? And artists, I mean, pop art is a result of that in my perception to a certain degree. You know, polka tricksterism, all kind of tricksterisms, no? Reacted to that trap of the of the binary coding of the Cold War and its semiotic squares. So you had to show that, art then basically became about ways of making these traps semantic and escaping them at the same time, noticing that it's actually not so, that these traps produce a strong mystification. No? And then some are aware of that, and then some buy into their own mystification because it's also comfortable. But speaking to some of the people who are engaged in magazines that have then, you know, been revealed as funded by the Congress for Cultural Freedom, basically a front organization for CIA, is very painful because many of them did not fully know, did not know at all, didn't want to know, did amazing work. I mean, Rasha knows because you contributed to this project as well.
Yeah, which is what I wanted. Yeah, so I researched the magazine that was CIA funded and that was in the Arabic language. And the guy, the editor, I mean, I've always known about that magazine and the fact that it was CIA funded, but it's only that myth that survived. And I was invited to participate to do this research around this. It's called Hiwar, the magazine, which means dialogue. The editor died, but it looked more like suicide. We don't know. But I remember what happened to me. So when I was asked to contribute an essay to the catalog, I wrote the first draft, I wrote the second draft, and then I decided, you know, I'm gonna come clean, actually. This shit still is meaningful here, and everybody who took a grant from the Ford Foundation, which was associated with the CIA, in my generation, was looked at as if it was CIA, and we asked ourselves this question of funding all the time. And so I decided to include that in the essay. And it took time. It took time for me to just say, to drop the mask, or to remove a layer of distance as a whatever curator, whatever bullshit that is. Yep. Okay, then we take a break and we come back in half an hour.
Oh, I have a question, sorry.
Ah, Magda.
I have a question to both of you, because actually both of those projects reflected on the hegemony of American art. And at the time we are talking about, there was another kind of hegemonic art practice that covered half of the globe, which was socialist realism, which basically isn't reflected on any level of global history writing, artistic experience whatsoever. I wanted to ask your question, why do you think is that? Is it because, as you mentioned, there were like not enough or no institution that could assure its success, or collectors that could assure its success, or is it because communist project failed and therefore we all forgot what happened like 50 years, 60 years ago?
If you were in Beirut 3 days ago, you would not say communism failed.
I'm coming from the East, so you know, the perspective changes.
Okay. I don't know if I would say anything smart, but I agree with you that what is very interesting in all the global art history is that Eastern Europe and Soviet art is completely absent, because we also think about global art in terms of decolonization, and so which doesn't fit Eastern Europe, so it's almost like it fits even less in the story. So I think I really thought 10 years ago when I was in graduate school that Eastern Europe was the big next thing, that you know everybody would get a job and that was the thing to study. And I've always been surprised that nothing so much happened.
Yeah, but I think, like when I said half of the globe, it's not only Eastern Europe, it's Latin America, it's China,
it's true.
Partly Southeast Asia.
But Latin American
really
art is also in the... I mean, Latin American art, there is a bit more, I think, that has been done on it. But I don't know. maybe you can say, but I agree with you, it's very interesting because it's complexified that there was a part, but it's not part of the narrative. And when we reconstruct it, we even add chapter, but they are rarely about this social country. Or the third, I mean, I found the third way. That's why I say the project of Russia and Christine is wonderful, because it highlights an entire other network. Well, I mean, I love the fact that there is no American in that. There is one, isn't it? An American in the exhibition? Oh, yes. But it's not really in the US yet. So you have, it's like a history of post-war art of the 70s without the US? I mean, can you think of something better to start? No, I mean, don't you think? Like something as a way to think about, and with so many Polish artists, with so many like people from Japan.
There's also Soviet artists, yes. But in the English part, there was not enough space, so they appear in Arabic.
But you know, this is, I think that's why I say the best way to do, like the most promising way to do art history is to do what Rasha and Christine did. But I'm serious, something that, and that's what we have been trying to do with Artlas. I mean, I cannot do it. I'm not a specialist of all those regions, but I can try to organize events and give a space where we hear about connection, we hear about like the rest, you know, and the rest seems to be everything actually, because it's so much more. Does it make sense? I think, you know, that's why if we add a chapter, it's never going to work. But what we can do is write other story where it's connection, it's an anti-apartheid exhibition in Japan. It's all this that allow us to think of the world of art as connected, as different. But then it also needs to be a collective project, because one person cannot write it, one exhibition cannot do it. It's multiple story, it's multiple perspective, it's multiple layer. That's why I think the book is a very good example where you learn so much, I mean, reading it, about Arab modernity, about Polish reality, East Germany, Japan, and so.
Yeah, I mean, there are, of course, projects on socialist realism that you know, I guess, but at the same time, it's really only beginning, you know, and really just, I don't know exactly what to think of or how to phrase well why this is so difficult, but I, for instance, in the Parapolitics exhibition, we did have a couple of, we had like, you know, one vitrine, two artworks, and several archival materials, like from also a bit lesser known, but like Seven Soviet Arts, a book by a journalist with the surname London, who had visited and wrote about the organization of the art system in 1937. And the book was very much praising of the Soviet art system, but it had one chapter that was describing a kind of trial. And that one had a really strong impact on the perception in the West. It was contributing to this whole kind of division of the intelligentsia from Moscow at the time. So elements like that were in the 1937 section, because it's just contemporaneous to that moment. I also showed the slide of without that book, though. We had a work by Liu Ding, who together with his partner, the art historian and curator Carol Yinghua Liu, is doing it for China since many years. And I also worked with them in China a bit on and we included a piece by him that is basically one painting that kind of deliriously condenses an entire coded, like, socialist realist canon, like the very because they have very precise measures for how, you know, how to represent heroes by 15% to enlarge the eyebrows, etc. So there is a very rigid. I mean, there's a lot of other things happening in Chinese art academies, you know, whether in the 50s or today, but there is also a relative constancy of a certain formulaic practice that this painting sort of all drew together. No, like it was just like one big moment of socialist realism, though of the Chinese branch. There's a project, I think, you know, in order to deal with this properly, I think you might have to do it with these kind of very ambivalent figures, or at least I believe in this. And there is one project that I think very highly of and hope that we will also be able to bring it here, that David Riff is organized shown in Moscow on this guy called Lifshitz. I forgot his first name now. It was a very powerful critic in the 20s and 30s, and also later on, I think he wrote up until the late 70s, wrote most of the entries on art in the Soviet encyclopedia, was in fact, you know, he was not Zhdanov, he was not in the political forefront in bringing people into line with socialist realist standards, but he was like the intellectual mastermind behind much of it, and a kind of very strange parallel figure to George Lucas in a very interesting way, but a highly complicated figure. And he did an exhibition on him and an ongoing research project, and I think it's really necessary that this travels. But it's also good that it started in Moscow.
Can I just say something? Because since we talk about the jeune peinture, and you know, there will be no May 68 poster, there will be no jeune peinture practice without the model of China, where several artists, including Fromanger, travel. This was their model for the poster. They went back to figuration on a Chinese model. So then it would make the link, but it's not something that we discussed. They were all Maoist.
They were all Maoist. And last year, for Claude Lazare in Paris, Christine and I, and there were so many events celebrating the 50th anniversary of May 68. And he was just like, we were walking and he said, anytime you see a poster that has clean borders, you know it's a fake. We never cut clean borders. We were like, and so you imagine like the extent to which the market has taken this small month in history and run with it. And I think that also answers your question. Okay, thank you very much, the two of you. And we take a small break and we come back at 6:00.